This year is on track to be the hottest year on record, and that's giving urgency to the UN climate talks that are underway in Lima, Peru. Representatives from nearly 200 countries are there to draft a new international agreement on climate change. The new treaty is scheduled to be adopted next year in Paris. William Mumma has been the lead author on 5 climate reports, and he's professor emeritus of international environmental policy at Tufts University. Thanks for coming to the studio.
It's very nice being here.
Other UN climate summits have not, as you well know, forged agreements that have been sufficient to tackle climate change. What gives you any hope whatsoever that this time in Peru things will be different?
It's fair to say that for 20 years, it's been largely kicking the can down the road, as they say. We'll get to it next year. And that also sounds where we are this year, because it's next year that we'll actually decide.
Yes, in Paris.
In Paris. But what is different is that for the first time, both the U.S. and China, who have frankly been hiding behind each other for the last 20 years as to who should go first, and then all other countries have been hiding behind them, have come to an interesting agreement. The fact that both the U.S. and China would each make a public commitment, it's actually not a binding legal commitment, but it is the term of art today is a political commitment. That is, by publicly acknowledging a strategy between now and 2025 for the U.S. and 2030 for the Chinese, they have signaled to the world that they are taking climate change seriously and are taking actions domestically to address it.
Okay. So do you see any knock-on effects as a result of that?
There really could be. I've already heard that it has strengthened the Europeans, who actually have already committed to a 40% reduction in their emissions by 2030. And it is engaged a number of developing countries who until now have not been required to do anything. The fact that China, quote, a developing country, has taken on an obligation as the biggest emitter in the world is changing the dynamic among developing countries to consider making similar commitments to reduce their emissions or to slow their emissions over the coming years.
And commitments is a key word here, because these are not mandatory, rigid regulations that have to be met. Why are these things still voluntary given the severity of the problem?
It's because the domestic politics in every country in the world, including the United States, the power of the fossil fuel industry has been able to block any change. There is the belief by many leaders in countries that you cannot have successful economic development without more carbon dioxide emissions.
And this is especially important for developing countries right now. They want to see their economy develop, and not necessarily without the benefit of fossil fuels.
Right. Well, the problem is that they have locked into the idea that they have to burn fossil fuels to get that development. And that is, I think, frankly, demonstrably not true. We're seeing actually some of the most rapid energy development is taking place in the area of zero or low carbon renewable energy. And the point is that nobody wants carbon dioxide. Nobody even wants energy. They want energy services. And if you can deliver those services without the carbon dioxide, without the ruinous development of land for getting fossil fuels out of the ground, then everyone should be happy.
One of the goals is to keep global warming within 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 Fahrenheit of pre-industrial times. This is the overall goal of United Nations talks. Temperatures are inching up toward that right now, 1.3 Fahrenheit. Then there is no stop to the amount of heat-trapping gases that are being emitted. If that's the case, compounding the problem seems to be the fact that these countries, when they submit data on their carbon emissions, for instance, they can't even agree on what data to submit. I mean, you want to compare apples and apples,
sure,
versus apples and oranges. But why is that not even agreed on at this point?
Well, I mean, some of it has to do with the diversity of sources. I mean, there's the direct carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels. There's the leakage of methane from natural gas and coal and oil production. And that's all pretty readily quantifiable. What is less quantifiable are some of the other industrial gases that trap heat, the nitrous oxide that comes from using nitrogen fertilizers in agriculture, the methane emissions from livestock and so forth. Those are hard to quantify well. On the other hand, we can certainly quantify what comes from fossil fuels. We can quantify what's coming from the damage and the cutting down of forests, the degrading of grasslands, all of those sources of carbon dioxide and methane we can quantify.
So you're saying that more could be done. At the same time, there are interesting comparisons that countries maybe should be making but can't really make.
Yes, and I received just this morning an interesting email from colleagues in India pointing out that the average Chinese and the average American will emit the same amount of carbon dioxide by 2030 if this agreement is achieved. And so India is left as the next in line now that China has moved out of the line of fire here on this issue. And they point out that by 2030, if India does nothing, they will be only emitting about one-third as much as the average Chinese and the average American.
They're not even going to come close.
And so therefore, why should they do anything?
So it's an emerging economy, and they say, look, we might be huge, but we're still way behind where you guys are on emissions.
That's correct.
So what do you do with that when you're in a place like Peru right now?
Well, I think what you do is you try to convince everyone that, first of all, 2030 is not the final number. It's not the final date. It is a way station on the way to a final solution. I would have to be honest with you and tell you that a lot of my colleagues think that it is no longer possible to stay within 2 degrees. To do so, we can burn basically the fossil fuels we're burning this year at that rate for 30 years and then no more. I don't know if that's possible or not. Technologically, it's possible. There is no question that we have the technologies that could replace all the fossil fuels and get us down to that level.
You have written 5 international reports on this subject, a subject critical to our survival. What is that process like? What are the rewards and what are the challenges, given that many of the countries that have pledged to take action haven't?
Well, the rewards are that you actually it's like being in one of the most exciting seminars that one can imagine. The ideas are flowing from people from all over the world. And from all sorts of disciplines. So you're not locked into the usual academic box that one is at most universities.
You're energized by it.
You're energized by it. And you also begin to understand what is working in some places and how it might be transferred to others. There's a report of equal size every 5-6 years that report comes out that talks about what we can do. It's filled with success stories from around the world.
So not only what we can do, but what we've done.
What we've done, what we can do, and what we might possibly do, and not only the technologies but the policies, the economics of it. And all of that points in the right direction. We can do this, and we can, I guess in business terms, we can do this and make a profit at the same time.
Thank you, William Uma, Professor Emeritus of International Environmental Policy at Tufts University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.